Well, what I'd like them to do, the leaders of the G7 conference, is I'd like them all to talk to each other and work out a plan that isn't just shifting the problem from one country to another, you know, but actually is a plan that we all work on together, which is how to deal with this waste and how to stop producing so much waste and how to recycle things. And all these issues have got to be dealt with globally. They can't be dealt with nationally, because that's where the problem is. So we need them all to get together, like we've put them together here, and deal with the problem.
The United Nations says 53 million tons of electronic waste are generated annually all over the world. It estimates that the amount of the waste will double in less than 30 years. If that happens, electronic waste would become the fastest growing waste stream in the world. Advanced robots are increasingly helping humans in a variety of innovative ways. Now, they have found a place in the healthcare system and will help nurses and doctors stay safe during the COVID-19 pandemic.
I can do all kinds of things for elderly people. I can visit with people and brighten their day with social stimulation, entertain and help guide exercise, but also can do talk therapy, take bio readings and help healthcare providers assess their health and deliver treatments.
Grace, which is the newest humanoid robot to join the healthcare fleet. This intelligent machine can take temperatures and record other vital signs of patients. It has been designed in a way to also interact with the elderly and those isolated by the pandemic. Grace is a new prototype of celebrity humanoid robot, Sophia, created by a robotic team in Hong Kong.
So we designed Grace to look professional in a healthcare setting. So that would mean so that she would resemble the sort of human-like appearance of healthcare staff. And so then this would facilitate more natural interactions. A human-like appearance facilitates trust and facilitates a natural engagement, because we're wired for human face-to-face interactions. That's just the way human beings are.
Hansen, a while standing between Sophia and Grace, also said that both robots could speak different languages. He said Grace's creation was aimed at relieving the burden of frontline hospital staff dealing with COVID-19 patients. The company is planning a mass production of Grace and offers them to the market by August. The cost of making this robot is similar to a luxury car, but the cost is likely to decrease once the company begins manufacturing it in its thousands.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
U.S. President Joe Biden's far-reaching domestic agenda in the United States is facing serious setbacks on a range of issues as the political quagmire of a tightly contested Senate is seeing Democratic ambitions sharply curtailed in the face of Republican obstruction. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Edward Helmore. The piece is titled, "Democrats' Domestic Agenda Faces Setbacks by Republican Obstructionism." U.S. President Joe Biden's far-reaching domestic agenda in the United States is facing serious setbacks on a range of issues as the political quagmire of a tightly contested Senate is seeing Democratic ambitions sharply curtailed in the face of Republican obstruction. On a number of key fronts, such as pushing election reform and voting rights, efforts to curb gun control, and to move forward on civil rights, there has been an effective pushback by Republicans and a handful of conservative Democrats that is forcing Joe Biden and the wider Democratic Party onto the back foot. The Senate, whom critics deride as an increasingly unrepresentative body that gives undue influence to smaller, less diverse Republican-run states, is scheduled to vote on Tuesday. Tuesday's vote will be on for the People Act, the voting rights bill that's certain to be defeated, having won no support from the Republicans. Republicans are expected to run down the clock, a controversial tactical rule known as a filibuster, under package that requires lawmakers to reach a 60-vote threshold. On Sunday, 20th of June, Ohio Republican Senator Rob Portman shut down amendments proposed by West Virginia's conservative Democrat Joe Manchin, whose rejection of the initial bill all but scuttled the Democrats' project. Senator Rob Portman described the planned legislation as a federal takeover of our election system. "The bottom line is we should make it easy to vote in this country. We should also make it hard to cheat," Senator Rob Portman said on NBC's Meet the Press. "Again, I appreciate Joe Manchin is trying to find that middle ground, and who knows, maybe something can be done." By forcing Republicans to carry out their filibuster and making their opposition clear and public to a law seen as defending the voting rights of communities of color, Democrats hope to embarrass the party. But without destroying the filibuster, which Senator Joe Manchin also opposes, there is little chance of the bill passing. Senate Democrats will also test calls for unity on civil rights and another bill, the Equality Act, that is in search of Republican support. Senator Chuck Schumer said last month the upper house is considering a vote on the bill but has yet to schedule it. Again, Senator Joe Manchin is the lone Democrat holdout. Proposed legislation would ban discrimination based on race, color, religion, and national origin. Wisconsin Senator Tammy Baldwin has said she is lobbying Republican colleagues but has achieved only incremental progress. Senator Tammy Baldwin has said she believes the Senate should hold off on a vote while negotiations are productive and progress is being made. The Senate is split 50-50 and only in Democratic control thanks to the tie-breaking vote of Vice President Kamala Harris. "There may be a time where there's an impasse. I'm still trying to find 10 Republicans to help pass the bill," said Senator Tammy Baldwin. Republicans' resistance to the legislation is focused on protecting the rights of religious institutions that condemn homosexuality, yet it comes against the backdrop of broad public, business, and judicial support on the issue. Senator Joe Manchin, an anti-abortion Democrat, has said he's not convinced that the Equality Act, as written, provides sufficient guidance to the local officials who will be responsible for implementing it. But he has also said he'll seek to build broad bipartisan support and find a viable path forward for these critical protections. Nor are Democrats currently likely to find broader opportunities for political unity on infrastructure spending, where large-scale Democratic proposals are running into Republican counteroffers of a fraction of the size. Former Republican presidential adviser Karl Rove told This Week with George Stephanopoulos, President Biden faces two paths on infrastructure and both are riddled with obstacles. It will be a bipartisan deal small enough to get Republican support, but not big enough to keep Democrats united, or a go-it-alone and go-for-broke plan that progressives want, with a price tag as high as $6 trillion. That's likely too big to pass, Karl Rove said. Similarly, pending gun control legislation may also be resistant to winning enough support to pass. As it stands, two House-passed bills to expand background checks on gun buyers have all but stalled out in the Senate. But rather than push legislation that Republicans will reject, Democrats may instead push for a vote on increasing the number of online and gun show sales covered by FBI background checks, a significant retreat on the original proposals.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Abacus, Small Enough to Jail, directed by Oscar-nominated filmmaker Steve James. And joining me in the studio, we have Matthew Turner, who's a freelance film critic who writes for Godzilla, iNews, and The List, among various other publications. And sitting next to him, we are also joined by political economist Clive Menzies, who is involved in Critical Thinking, a research and educational project which seeks to understand how the political economy works and identify levers for change. Now, this documentary centers on the Abacus Federal Savings Bank, a small American Chinese-owned family bank situated in Manhattan's Chinatown in New York City, which, because it was deemed small enough to jail rather than too big to fail, became the only financial institution to actually face criminal charges following the mortgage crisis in 2008. And born in Shanghai, Thomas Song founded Abacus Federal in 1984, hoping to make it easier for Chinese immigrants to get loans. And the bank eventually became a community hub, but in 2012, the Manhattan District Attorney's Office charged it with mortgage fraud, also indicting 19 of its former employees. And this film shows the Song family fighting back against the charges and the toll it takes on them, as well as the Chinese community.
Today, we are announcing the indictment of the Federal Savings Bank on mortgage fraud, securities fraud, and conspiracy. A federally chartered bank that has been catering to the Chinese immigrant community since 1984.
If you were going to pick on a bank, a family-owned company, wedged between a couple of noodle shops in Chinatown, is about as easy a target as you could possibly pick.
When I was a lawyer, there was no bank owned by Chinese and serving the Chinese.
When I walk around here, I feel very much at home. This is a very tasty noodle shop.
That's always special. That's the butt.
When we were children, my dad was excited about this bank he was going to start.
We serve people who've never even dealt with the banking system before.
This whole ordeal began in 2009.
One of our loan officers stole money.
He's lying all over the place.
He was running a money laundering operation. I fired him that day.
They went straight to their regulator, and they told them about it.
The DA's office started asking us questions.
Wait a minute, maybe we're the target.
If that prosecution goes through, that bank is going to go out of business.
Although this is David versus Goliath, they're a whole family of lawyers.
We spent a lot of time investigating and ended up absolutely convinced that the loan department was corrupt through and through.
They routinely falsified mortgage documents.
Reporters in this town were treated to this extraordinary photo opportunity. This almost Stalinist-looking chain gang
herded like cattle down the hallway. I've been doing this for 25 years, and I'd never seen that happen.
Mommy's worried. Papa's 80 years old. He's been up since 5:30 a.m. He has nothing to eat for dinner. Let's get you some food. Papa, you do.
This is how he is. He's very calm, and I'm like a jumping bean. So I'm always running around.
You're going to eat out. You're old and mad, okay? You're not a young kid anymore.
It's killing you. Abacus Federal Savings Bank had one of the nation's lowest default rates, not the highest. One of the lowest. Frankly, if every bank had underwritten as well as Abacus, we wouldn't have had a financial crisis.
People get the wrong impression that Chinese are not law-abiding.
This case is an attack on our community. We're easy prey.
Too big to fail turns into small enough to jail, and Abacus is small enough to jail.
Well, very well and welcome to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, this documentary, I think, gives a refreshing look at the banking crisis in that, unlike many documentaries and films in this subject, we get to see the more personal stories and the social impact the crash had. Now, Matthew, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on Abacus Small Enough to Jail?
Well, one of the most interesting things about it is we're used to seeing the big guy versus little guy stories, but the big guy is usually the bank. Right? In this case, the little guy is the bank, and that sort of perspective, that sort of family-oriented perspective of it, is very interesting. I really enjoyed the film. I thought it was a strong story. Like, you care deeply about the family and get to know them very well. The director, as you said, he made Hoop Dreams and he made the Roger Ebert documentary Life Itself, and he's very good at those sort of small, intimate family stories. And it's a very effective story, very, very well told. The court case stuff is interesting, if not perhaps quite as dramatic as you're maybe expecting. I mean, I don't think the outcome of the film is particularly in doubt, but it's still a very enjoyable, you know, piece to watch.
And Clive, if I could turn to you, what was your take on the film? Would you agree with what Matthew said?
Yeah, I think it was a very good film as a story of itself. And I think they gave enough suggestion of this too big to fail versus small enough to jail. But to actually do that whole story justice is really two films, and maybe something like The Big Short and this together actually show you more of the picture.
And what did you make of Matthew's point that this dynamic between sort of the big guy not being the bank in this case, but the small guy?
Well, arguably the banks control the regulatory system anyway, so it's not really surprising. And our analysis would suggest that this was a targeted attempt to show that they were doing something about the crisis whilst quite willfully ignoring egregious crimes on a much larger scale.
And Matthew, as you were saying, you said that Steve James is good at telling personal family stories. In this documentary, though, it's quite politically charged. Do you think he was making a political statement?
I certainly think he was trying to. I mean, you have the press conferences and that Cyrus Vance, the DA, gives, where he's very sort of explicitly targeting the banks, whereas actually the reality is it's a very small bank and nothing really related to what you call Wall Street. And you have the quite extraordinary the scene we just saw in the clip there with the chain gang, which is just really shocking anyway. And everybody interviewed in the film says that they've been working in this business 25 years or more and they've never seen anything like that. And the implication is they would never have done that to white bankers, black bankers, you know, anything like that.
Exonerating our entire community, no matter what we do, be it the little guy selling vegetables or a bank that's doing business. I told Mr. Song, I'm glad they pick on you. Because you're a fighter.
Cyrus Vance just felt this is easier to attack, especially as a family bank. But he doesn't realize Tom is not easy to be pushed around. And my girls, they're tough, smart, capable women, so courageous.
Although this is David versus Goliath, David being Abacus Federal Savings Bank has a slingshot. That is, you know, their whole family of lawyers.
I was going to be able to fight this.
they're almost gleeful. They're like, we're going to have her day in court now. We're actually going to be able to show that they were wrong.
They made a decision that they were not going to plead guilty to something that they didn't feel the bank was guilty of. That is a courageous choice, and it's an expensive choice. The DA's office has hundreds of lawyers and took 5 years to do their grand jury investigations, and it is a daunting task to fight the government.
You could feel the enormous weight on their shoulders and the sort of stacks that are against them. Matthew, what did you make of their efforts of the Sun family to fight back?
Well, the filmmaker Steve James picks up the. I guess he's come on board the story somewhere after the. After the court case begins and but before the result of the trial. So the cameras are actually there when the verdicts come in you get a lot of the, you're not obviously allowed cameras inside the courtroom, but there's a lot of court reconstruction, so you have a feel for how the toll that the trial itself is taking on them. And yeah, I mean, as that clip showed, they're very sort of feisty characters, and they're all three of the women are lawyers, and they're really, yeah, they're very hungry for the fight, if you like. You don't really get a sense of how the investigation is going from the other side. You only see them and their efforts to sort of fight back, and what they're doing as a family. You don't really get a sense of the DA's office. There are a couple of interviews with people who are involved in the DA's office, but they don't really tell you anything of great interest.
Mm-hmm. And Clive, would you agree? What did you make of the Sun's family challenges and their struggle to fight back against the DA? Do you think they were justified?
They were certainly justified. I suspect the DA were quite surprised at the strength of their fight back, because I think the Chinese community, or Chinese as a culture, are generally quite diffident and respectful of authority. And I think they hoped to actually ship them into pleading guilty, and they failed.
I mean, absolutely, there is a clip where Tom Sung, basically, he's offered a plea deal, and then they just says, no, I'm not going to take that plea deal. And it's really obvious that the DA's department thought they would just take that plea deal and, you know, all their problems would just magically go away. But no, that's, they, you know, they
see this right all the way
yeah,
to the end.
Yeah, they don't take the deal, exactly. And, I mean, as you say, it cost them $10 million. So another smaller business maybe wouldn't have been able to fight that the way they did.
In fact, why was it then that, as the film claims, that Abacus was the only financial institution to actually face criminal charges following the 2008 financial crisis? You know, why don't we hear about major firms like Lehman Brothers, Bear Stearns, or Countrywide being held to account?
Could you imagine the outrage if you had Jewish bankers chained like they chained those employees? There's a very simple reason. The fraud that they're talking about in this film is nothing to do with the subprime crisis in terms of what crimes were actually committed, because the loan default rate on the Fannie Mae loans, the injured party was supposedly Fannie Mae, who made a lot of money out of this bank's loan book. And there were 9 defaults out of 3,000 mortgages. And actually, as it says in the film, their loan history was infinitely better than anyone else. What was happening in the subprime crisis is what people were packaging up garbage and selling it. There are stories of senior managers in Standard & Poor's, the credit rating agencies, being shouted at, being told to rate stuff, even though they didn't have the files on which to rate it. So there was this huge fraud, this creation of an illusion of some sort of quality in a mortgage book that was full of holes, unlike Abacus Bank, which had really well-documented loans. Yes,
they had a case of a bad apple, but they fired the man who
yes,
was giving out
there is
bad
obviously
loans.
A cultural element to this case, which is debt is a social construct in a community. If I'm related to you and I lend you money, whether you pay me back is much less important than if I've signed a piece of paper with someone. And that is a culture of this community. And you could argue that there was fraudulent documentation, but it wasn't obscuring what was actually going on in the way it was going on in the subprime crisis, where people who were never going to be able to pay it, they didn't have cash earnings on the side that they weren't declaring. They were never going to be able to repay these loans. And the people selling those mortgages knew that, and they bet against their clients at the same time. So the criminality of the system, which controls most of the regulation as well, is actually trying to use this little bank as some sort of flag waving that we're jailing bankers. The only country to jail bankers was Iceland, and they jailed 28. Every other country capitulated. And this case had nothing to do with the subprime crisis.
I'm a former prosecutor. I'm not soft on crime. I've never seen a spectacle like this. These people were humiliated intentionally for no good reason.
It is not the district attorney's office's decision whether or not to put people in handcuffs, but people who were brought into court who have been charged with crimes are put into handcuffs. That's a decision that's made by the court officers. I won't go into it more than that because, you know, it's not something I'm involved with.
So in the film, we learn that the Abacus Bank plays an important role in the Chinese community. And we also find that it provides mortgages to immigrants who live sort of in a cash economy and have hidden assets. And we also learn more about Thomas Sung and his character in this film and his intentions, his noble intentions in starting the bank, as he believes that Chinese immigrants were being left out of the American dream. And what did you make of his character and his story?
Well, and the film explicitly uses clips from Frank Capra's It's a Wonderful Life. The opening shot of the movie is Thomas Sung and his wife watching it and identifying very strongly with James Stewart's character, George Bailey, and particularly his position within the sort of small town community, what feels like a small town community, and helping people with small businesses. And he knows all the businesses, everybody knows who he is, and stuff like that. So there is very much that sort of man of the people element to Thomas Sung's story, I think.
And there's a scene in the documentary where we see that he's able to calm the crowds of all the clients who are rushing to get their money back, and he's able to soothe them.
Exactly like happens in It's a Wonderful Life. And in fact, the film shows clips of that exact same scene happening. It shows clips of George Bailey speaking to the crowd, preventing a run on the bank by telling them that your money's in his business and your money's in his business, and everybody's kind of helping each other. And you don't actually see Sung calming his own crowd, but he tells you have him telling the audience what he actually did, which is basically exactly the same thing. He went out and told everyone, calm down, you know, trust me, you know me, I'm here, you know, your money's safe, and it worked.
It was an uncanny moment. Yes, yeah. Absolutely. And Clive, the film shows and suggests that there were racial implications behind the charges. Why were they being singled out? Was it because they were Chinese?
I don't think it was racist in the sense that the Chinese are dishonest. I think it was the Chinese were seen as a soft touch. As Matthew said, you know, that they were visibly shocked when they wouldn't cut it and plead for guilty. Mm-hmm. They preferred to fight. And I think that was their undoing. Other than that, I don't think it was racist as such as demonizing a community, but clearly it had that effect. It's interesting, Matthew talked about It's a Wonderful Life, and banking is an inherently dishonest business, which I won't go into. But what has been banking's salvation over the years is the relationships, and that's what banking always used to be based on. But that has completely gone with these mega banks. So there is no relationship. So you are dependent on the forms, whereas in a bank like Abacus, you're dependent on the relationships, and that's what their business is. And that's in stark contrast to what was going on elsewhere and being ignored.
That's a really interesting point. Did you want to add anything to that, Matthew?
There was, on the racism element, there is a very telling comment from, I think it's the BA, correct me if I'm wrong, but where he says, oh, well, no, of course we weren't racist. We didn't treat them any differently to the way we treat South American bankers or, you know, Russian bankers or, you know, he sort of lists another,
other ethnic
groups, yeah, but leaves one kind of fairly major group out, white bankers, and that's the kind of fairness you'd at least expect.
I never thought my girls would work in Chinatown because we lived in Greenwich, Connecticut. Tom would be commuting every day, you know, like an hour and a half each way. So he didn't see them that much in those days. They had no idea anything, not a faintest idea about the Chinese community. In fact, Heather still doesn't. She hates the city, you know. She's like me. We both have headaches. And at home, well, we don't want them to understand we speak Chinese.
You always said to me, if you come work for the bank, the benefit will be you have a 9-to-4 job.
9-to-4?
Because a long time ago, people could leave at 3 for the bank. He said, you can have children, you can have a family.
You know what he said to me? He said, if you wish to work with me, remember, this is your own choice. And don't think it's going to be easy. You gave you two different stories.
They're very endearing, warm family, and it makes you wonder, I wonder if any other bank CEOs are this caring. Matthew, I just wanted to ask for your brief views on the family themselves and how they're portrayed.
I think they're great. I mean, they're very entertaining dynamic between certainly the daughters and the mother. The mother's the real star of the movie, in my opinion. And she sort of undercuts all of them with quite sort of funny comments. There's a whole sequence, a whole bizarre sequence where they're all sort of stressing about the sandwich that the father is eating and whether it's too dry and is he enjoying it and is he sure he's enjoying it and all that sort of stuff. Yeah, you get a
real
feel
for it. But then it just highlights the unfairness of the situation, that there's an old man enduring this ordeal.
Yeah, he's 80. He's 75 when the prosecution begins, and he's 80 when it finishes. Although I have to say, he looks pretty damn good for 80.
Yeah, not bad at all. And Clive, I'd like to talk about the wider issues now of the film. Why isn't there, I get the sense of this theme in the film, that there's a lack of accountability in the banking world. What do you make of this?
If you look at the personalities and the structures, they're all related. So the banks, in effect, control the central banks, they control the regulators, and so what appears to be wrongdoing can always be covered up. So you take the example of HSBC money laundering. They confessed. So the Department of Justice had a cast iron case. They were lent on by a combination of George Osborne, Adair Turner, and Mark Carney. Chancellor of the Bank of England, head of the FSA at the time, and Chancellor of the Exchequer. They all sit on the Bank of International Settlements Board. So there is this web of power that sits over the financial system that actually ensures its own survival. That's why they bullied Congress into bailing out the banks in 2008, because they control
the levers
of power.
And we saw this in our country as well. Why is there such a tight relationship between the banks and the government? Aren't the banks supposed to serve the people?
Well, it comes back to that Rothschild quote, that let me control a nation's money supply, and I care not about its laws. Simply money gives you control, particularly when you can create that money from nothing. So you can buy politicians, you can bribe politicians, you can pay people to kill politicians. So what's a politician got to do? He's got to obey orders.
There's some very hot issues you raise. But does this film evoke these sort of wider questions and raise issues about the morality of banking? Did you get that sense also from watching this documentary?
In this particular story, it's more focused on this small family and their small bank, and how, as Clive said, that this what happens to the Sun family is not related to the wider financial crisis. It's not the same, you know, the same thing. So in that sense, no. But you are very much aware of the financial crisis in the background, and certainly, like I said, the press conference that DA Cyrus Vance gives, where he gives this very sort of ebullient statement about, well, yes, we're going to be jailing these bank effect, well, words to the effect of, we're going to be jailing these bankers, without really going into the detail. Yeah, certainly that's there.
Well, certainly we learn that they emerge victoriously from this, the Sung family.
Spoiler, but yes.
Yes, a little spoiler, but I think it's public knowledge sort of now that this court case has gone on. But just final thoughts now. Matthew, what's your verdict on this film, and would you recommend it?
I would certainly recommend it. It's a very entertaining story. It makes you angry a little bit, and it's, you know, it's always interesting to see film documentaries where there's a strong sense of injustice, and particularly if it ends well, then that's, you know, all for the better. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I enjoyed it certainly.
And final thoughts to you also, Clive, would you recommend this documentary?
I certainly would. What spoke volumes to me is that Ken Yu, the DA star witness, was the original fraudster that was reported by the bank to the authorities, and they revoked his plea bargain at the end and charged him. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that tells you exactly what was going on.
I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there, but just quickly.
I just wanted to add to that, actually, that really stuck out for me as well. Like, not only that, the original fraudster becomes the prosecution's star witness, which is just insane. I really couldn't understand that at all, like how that was allowed to happen. Basically, somebody who has confessed to lying and been caught lying and committing fraud becomes the star witness. Mm-hmm.
It's a very puzzling business indeed, but I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there, and we'll come to the end of this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
In the limelight.
The head of climate change at the United Nations has warned that world leaders are still far away from securing a deal to limit the disastrous effects of global heating, with less than 5 months to go before a key summit in Glasgow, Scotland. Time is now running out, said Patricia Espinosa, who was formerly Foreign Minister of Mexico, but now leads the United Nations on climate policy. She told The Observer that although advances had been made at the G7 meeting in Cornwall, progress had not been made on honoring past commitments to find $100 billion, or £72.5 billion, a year to help developing countries invest in green technologies. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Observer columnists Toby Helm and Robin McKee. The piece is titled United Nations Blasts World Leaders for Failing to Seal £72 billion a Year Deal on Climate. Stay with us for more of Toby Helm and Robin McKee's article. Climate change at the United Nations has warned that world leaders are still far away from securing a deal to limit the disastrous effects of global heating, with less than 5 months to go before a key summit in Glasgow, Scotland. Time is now running out, said Patricia Espinosa, who was formerly Foreign Minister of Mexico, but now leads the United Nations on climate policy. Espinosa told The Observer that although advances had been made at the G7 meeting in Cornwall, progress had not been made on honoring past commitments to find $100 billion, or equivalently £72.5 billion a year, to help developing countries invest in green technologies. we're still very far from being fully confident of having a full success at COP26, she said. The United Nations Climate Conference, opening on 31st of October in Glasgow, Scotland, is considered to be of special importance in the battle against global warming, which is now melting ice sheets, raising sea levels, destroying coral reefs, and disrupting weather systems across the planet. The Paris Climate Agreement in 2015 pledged that nations would try to limit temperature rises to less than 1.5 degrees Celsius by drastically limiting fossil fuel emissions, the principal cause of global warming. Glasgow will be the first opportunity to assess the impact of the promises made in Paris in 2015 and to implement new measures to avert global catastrophe. The Group of Seven, the G7, had offered hope that this process could be boosted in advance of COP26, the Glasgow Climate Change Conference 2021. But Patricia Spinoza expressed disappointment, saying, "Regarding finance, I'd have really hoped for a clearer signal on how and when we will be able to see the commitment to mobilize the $100 billion fulfilled." Honoring the pledge is seen as critical if developing countries are to come into line with plans to cut greenhouse gas emissions and take costly steps necessary to reduce their reliance on fossil fuels. At the G7 meeting, there were commitments to get to the target before the Glasgow Climate Change Conference 2021, but a lack of detail remained about precisely how much money the wealthier nations would be willing to give. This is one condition to be able to have a good basis to have a successful COP26, Patricia Spinoza said. It is essential. We cannot afford a lack of success. COP26 should be able to give some sense of hope to the world. And there isn't much time. We are already in the second half of June. This point was backed by Rachel Kite, Dean of Fletcher School at Tufts University in Massachusetts and a former United Nations climate envoy. Rachel Kite said, "The G7 meeting failed to lead when it didn't agree how to fulfill the $100 billion promise. Their apparent strategy of brinkmanship is wrong-headed. Many around the world are already at the brink," she said. The United Kingdom has 6 months left to its G7 presidency and 5 months to go until COP26, the Glasgow United Nations Climate Change Summit. Boris Johnson has to muster the world to significant climate finance commitments, proposing development finance and detail behind the Global Marshall Plan that President Biden calls Build Back Better World. Then and only then can we get the agreement we need in Glasgow. Patricia Spinoza added that there were still doubts about whether the summit would be held with all delegates attending in person, or whether it might be staged partly or wholly in a virtual format. If there were surges in COVID-19, plans would have to be adapted accordingly. As Spinoza said, "We're working on all possible scenarios, from a fully-fledged conference to a conference that would be virtual," she said. It is true, the UK presidency is working very hard to have a physical meeting.
Iran's Judiciary Chief Seyed Ebrahim Raisi has won Iran's 2021 presidential election by a landslide, he managed to secure nearly 18 million of the votes and become the 8th president of the Islamic Republic. Some 29 million Iranians voted in Iran's 13th presidential election. Raisi won the presidential race amid an all-out political and media war led by the United States and its Western and regional allies targeting the event. The Islamic Republic's opponents attempted to portray a gloomy picture of the polls to discourage popular contribution. However, the Iranian people foiled the enemy's plots as the turnout was beyond their perceived low notion. Also, the public reception forced officials to extend the time limit on the election, with polls remaining open until past midnight. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, praised the epic turnout in Iran's 13th presidential election. The leader said the high turnout neutralized the campaigns launched by the enemy's media outlets and ill-wishers to create voter apathy in the election. Ayatollah Khamenei said nothing could break the Iranian nation's will and disrupt the election. Meanwhile, the outgoing Iranian president Hassan Rouhani met president-elect Ebrahim Raisi in person to congratulate. The outgoing president stated his full support for his successor and stressed his willingness to offer assistance to the new government. In turn, president-elect Raisi pledged all-out efforts to resolve the country's problems, especially those affecting the people's livelihoods. Raisi noted that he would consult with the outgoing administration, parliament, and the elites to achieve the goal. Iran's president-elect Ebrahim Raisi received congratulatory messages from several world leaders for winning Friday's presidential election, including Russian President Vladimir Putin, who expressed hope for further development of constructive cooperation between Moscow and Tehran. Raisi will take office in 45 days. He has promised to form a hard-working, anti-corruption and revolutionary cabinet and fight corruption and uproot poverty.
You know, we can say that the main and the only loser in this election was were those who actually were discouraging themselves from going to the ballot boxes and turn out to vote. And either those politicians inside Iran or those dissident Iranians outside Iran, who, in some cases, who attacked actually the voters against the law. So they were the main losers because they were trying to discourage people to turn out, to say that people are not supporting the government, and that means that there is lack of legitimacy, and because of that, the government should not be respected and considered respected, actually, in recognized in by other countries.
Sixty-year-old Ebrahim Raisi will take office in August. He is the 8th president of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Raisi has promised to fight corruption and uproot poverty. He campaigned with the slogan, Popular Administration, Strong Iran, on a platform of uprooting corruption in the executive branch, fighting poverty and inflation, and creating jobs. President-elect Raisi is set to take power at a critical time as Iran seeks to salvage its tattered nuclear deal with major powers and free itself from illegal and inhumane U.S. sanctions that have driven a sharp economic downturn. Washington has been using sanctions as a weapon by preventing Iran from buying even its necessities and blocking the country's access to its overseas financial resources. Ebrahim Raisi had stated before that he would vigorously pursue efforts to get rid of sanctions imposed by the United States. He had said that his government would not allow the economy to be conditioned by the fate of sanctions removal talks, adding that Iranians want the economy to be stable.
You know, first, either the Americans lift the sanctions or not, Iran is going to diversify its basket of the diplomacy and the foreign policy and relations with other countries. So Iran has signed a memorandum of understanding for 25 years with China, is working on something similar to that with Russia and with some other countries. And it means that Iran is going to move forward and move on from the JCPOA and do not rely only on that. It's not the basket to put all the eggs on that.
President-elect Ebrahim Raisi has vowed to pursue sanctions removal efforts. He has noted that one should not deal abjectly with those who want to trample over the rights of the Iranian people. With him being the president, Washington is faced with a choice: remove all sanctions and return to compliance if it truly wants to save the nuclear deal, or follow the path of its past, confrontation and threats. Meanwhile, Iran has forged strong ties with both Russia and China and will proceed with its agenda with or without the U.S.
Relations between the United States and Russia came under the spotlight this week as presidents of the two geopolitical rivals sat down for talks in Geneva. Before the meeting, Washington and Moscow had acknowledged that relations were at rock bottom. A series of tit-for-tat actions, which escalated in recent years, has left bilateral diplomatic ties in tatters. Moscow and Washington are at loggerheads over a host of issues, including the situation in Ukraine, arms control, human rights, and cybersecurity. The depth of differences between the two sides had dashed hopes of any breakthrough during the meeting between the U.S. President Joe Biden and his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin. The Geneva talks lasted around 3 hours. The two presidents did not even come close to resolving any of the acrimonious conflicts that have sent U.S.-Russian ties to their lowest level in decades. However, Biden and Putin agreed to launch a dialogue on atomic arms control. They also said that they would return ambassadors to Washington and Moscow to ease diplomatic contacts. The ambassadors were withdrawn in March for consultations after Washington accused Moscow of interference in America's 2020 presidential election. That is a claim that Moscow vehemently denies. The agreements in Geneva this week have somehow reduced bilateral tensions for now, but it is definitely too early to know whether the two rivals will eventually engage in meaningful cooperation. The presidents of the U.S. and Russia hailed their dialogue in Geneva. The Russian president said Biden was an experienced statesman. But despite the pleasantries, deep differences persisted in the meeting and after that. There was almost no sign of agreement on issues like cybersecurity and Ukraine, where Russia and the West have been locked in a tug of war for years. Putin warned the U.S. against imposing new sanctions on Russia. Putin and Biden also clashed over human rights issues with the American leader, threatening devastating consequences for Moscow if Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny, who is now serving a 2.5-year sentence, died in jail.
As we know, Washington loves to throw human rights violation allegations against everyone, which is now extremely ironic because the current official president of the United States and many Democrats around him acknowledge that the Black Lives Matter movement has legitimate gripes with the United States. And the Black Lives Matter movement is a movement that claims that the United States grossly violates the human rights of its own citizens.
Putin dismissed U.S. concerns about Navalny, telling Biden that the opposition leader had ignored the law. The Russian president also criticized the status of human rights in America. Putin specifically named the Black Lives Matter movement and the January 6th attack on Capitol as two cases that show the U.S. has its own grave human rights-related problems. Observers believe it is too soon to judge the outcome of the Geneva meeting. Can the two rivals somehow build on their recent meeting, bridge their differences, and hammer out compromises in the future?
If you look back to the 1990s, after the triumph in the Cold War, the United States sat down, well, certain important elites sat down and wrote the Project for a New American Century. And one of the absolute and most key points of that project, to make the century completely American, is to not allow a new competitor to rise. And when you have this sort of zero-sum game, 0-1, you know, win or lose sort of scenario, there's really no way to find any sort of true compromise or make any sort of friendly deal of any sort of meaning.
Bilateral talks on strategic arms limitations could start in a matter of weeks. The talks could serve as a test of the two sides' political will to engage in meaningful diplomacy and cooperation.
Iran's health minister, Saeed Namaki, announced on Monday that the Coviran Barakat coronavirus vaccine have received approval for public inoculations.
A legal commission gave approval to the Barakat vaccine for emergency use. The Barakat complex can now distribute the vaccines it's produced. God willing, the vaccine will be added to the national vaccination program starting next week.
He said that Iran had gone through nearly a year of intensive work to join the club of countries in the world with the capacity to scale up production for coronavirus vaccines. Coviran Barakat was unveiled on December 29, 2020, and started to be mass-produced on March 29. It's been developed by Shifa Farmid, a subsidiary of the Iranian economic and industrial conglomerate Sattar. The factory says its production capacity will reach 12 to 15 million doses per month in summer. Iran is among the first countries which started developing a vaccine against the coronavirus, and now four companies are endeavoring to release their products by September and inoculate the whole population.
The ability of Iran to develop its own vaccine is a step forward. It would have been a lot easier, I suspect, had there been no sanctions on some of the chemicals and other things needed to develop the vaccines. So I think we have to go back to these principles. If we are serious, if the United States is serious about moving forward to prevent the spread of this virus and to save lives, then there has to be an open-handed, generous, and honest relationship with Iran, with Cuba, with China and Russia and other makers of vaccines, including India and South Africa, all of which has been impeded by this emphasis on privatization and the maintenance of sanctions.
Iran hopes that domestic initiatives could significantly boost vaccine supplies for a nationwide inoculation program that started last year. The G7 summit in the United Kingdom ended with a pledge to distribute 1 billion doses of COVID-19 vaccine to the developing world, a figure that activists say is a drop in the bucket in the fight against the coronavirus pandemic. In the meantime, some Western nations have been accused of hoarding the vaccines, even though their inoculation programs have lost their momentum. Others are also accusing them of engaging in vaccine diplomacy, taking advantage of vaccine donations to seek diplomatic favors, something that even the Western countries have acknowledged.
There's no doubt that some of this is going about, and we don't support vaccine diplomacy, let alone blackmail. We think that we've got a moral duty, but also a strong vested interest in getting the world vaccinated, because we know no one's safe until we're all safe.
The major pharmaceutical companies are yet to grant a waiver on the intellectual property rights behind the production of their COVID-19 vaccines, a move that would facilitate poorer nations' access to the jabs. Meanwhile, nations like Iran and Cuba have joined forces to develop their vaccines to protect their population against the coronavirus pandemic.
From my point of view, I think it's great that Iran has been able to develop a vaccine working with the Cubans and the Russians and others. And this is an important step. And I think it's one reason why the United States began to say the other day, about 3 weeks ago now, well, maybe we should relax the patents and so on and so forth. But the whole system in the last 18 months reduced the speed and the efficacy of the distribution of the vaccine.
As major vaccine producers keep away the doses from the rest of the world, vaccines built by developing countries can be a beacon of hope for millions of people.
Saudi authorities have executed a young man for crimes he allegedly committed as a teenager. Mustafa al-Darwish exhausted his final appeals at the end of May, and his execution was approved by the office of the Saudi king. In the last week of May 2021, Mustafa al-Darwish's case was referred to the Presidency of State Security. The judicial process around this case is not transparent. human rights organizations, including Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and the UK-based legal rights organization Reprieve, called al-Darwish's case particularly concerning. Saudi authorities claim he confessed to various crimes, but his family said he has not had adequate legal representation. Al-Darwish